overtime is the time where you didn't think you'd have the time, but where like every second counts. And we can choose to live like we're in the first quarter and like, oh, you know, overtime's a long way from now. But the reality is we're all in overtime, and that can be scary, but it can be clarifying. And so if you can live with a mindset that you're in overtime and you want to make the most of every second, at least for me, it's given me so much joy in life because I get to go after those things that are really important to me.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. This is the first of two episodes where we dive deep into drugs and ask two big questions. First, how can we make them more affordable? And second, how can we make them more available for diseases that have no cures? And that's the focus of today's conversation. After today's guest, David Feigenbaum, almost died five times from Castleman's disease, he used his own knowledge as a doctor and scientist to try to come up with a cure. After many stops and starts, he found an already approved drug not meant for treating Castleman's that could be repurposed to treat his condition. And now he's scaling that approach, repurposing drugs meant for other illnesses to help find cures for the 14,000 rare diseases that have no approved medications. Please welcome David Feigenbaum to The Other 80. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having
me. This is like fancy digs here we got here. But apparently this is your second and going on third time in one of these studios this week in New York.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
It was really fun to meet David. And one of the questions I asked him is whether he knew Matt Mite. And Matt is one of my very favorite people.
He's the best.
So that endears you to me and hopefully to the audience as well.
Matt's incredible. He's just the most amazing example of a rigorous scientist who is such an advocate for the right things to be done. And he's also, as you know, a family member of Bertrand, who of course passed from his rare disease. And Matt just inspires me so much.
Yeah. You're the founder of Every Cure, which connects rare disease patients with repurposed drugs. And we'll get more into what that means. I think probably every interview starts with your personal story. Tell us how you got to this moment of starting this organization.
Sure. So I decided to go into medicine after my mom passed away from cancer when I was a sophomore in college. And that, for me, just drove me to want to find treatments for patients like her. I promised her that I would do that. And so that became my laser focus. And fast forward, I was a third-year med student at UPenn on that journey to help patients in memory of my mom. And then I became critically ill myself with a horrible disease called Castleman disease. I nearly died five times in the next 3 years from this horrible disease, had my last rites read when I was 25, needed transfusions to keep me alive, needed lots and lots of chemotherapy to save my life. And by the fourth time I almost died from my disease, which was when I was on an experimental drug and it didn't work, I realized that I would need to dedicate my life. If I wanted to survive, if I wanted any chance to survive, I would have to dedicate my life to trying to find a drug that could save me. And I didn't have $1 billion in 15 years to make a new drug. So I thought, well, maybe I could take an old drug that exists for another disease and try to repurpose it for me. And I eventually discovered an existing drug called sirolimus. It saved my life. And the moment that drug started saving my life, I have not been able to stop thinking about how many more drugs are already available that are approved for another condition that are at our CVS that could actually treat a lot more diseases.
Let's dig into that a little bit.
Sure.
It sounds simple. What did you actually do?
Sure. So I started storing blood samples on myself back in the middle of 2012, with the idea being that I was on chemotherapy at the time to try to keep my disease under control, but I was worried that I was going to relapse. And so I started storing blood samples every couple of weeks, with the idea being that if I relapsed and if I survived, we could thaw those samples and then see if we could figure out what was going wrong in my immune system. So then we could maybe figure out, is there a drug that could save me? Because we didn't have enough data. Like so many rare diseases, there was very limited data. I know that's such a passion for you. Limited data about the disease. And the only way we could find a drug to save me is if I could generate some new data. So I stored those samples. I had that fifth relapse. I nearly died for that fifth time. And I said goodbye to my family, my girlfriend, Caitlin, she was actually my fiance at the time, and my sisters and my dad. And then I started to wake up a couple of days later because I didn't die, because these chemotherapies saved my life, a combination of seven of them. And I remember the moment I started to wake up and come to and realize, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get another shot at this. I'm going to get more life. And in that additional time I'll have, I got to try to find a drug to save me. As soon as I started to wake up, I remember asking my sister, Gina, and my girlfriend, Caitlin, who were in the room, to start getting blood samples, data, everything they could send to Philadelphia, because I was hospitalized in Arkansas at the time. Get it to Philadelphia. I'm going to try to find a drug that could save me. And so I did a bunch of experiments, serum proteomics. I measured 1,000 proteins in my blood. I did flow cytometry, looked at the activation status of a bunch of immune cells, and putting all that together, discovered that this one part of my immune system called mTOR, this communication line, was in overdrive. And I was so excited to see that because there's a drug that can turn that thing off.
Mm, wow. You've said often that waiting and hoping is not enough.
That's right.
And we need to turn hope into action. And also a quote from your mom, during difficult times, we are often told to look for silver linings, but we should be creating silver linings.
That's right.
And I'm curious, those two statements, hope is not enough, let's turn it into action, and then let's create silver linings. How did that shape the initial phases of the work that you're doing now?
Oh, it's such a great question. I love that you shared that lesson my mom taught me. I think that so often hope for a future that we want is enough to sort of sustain us. You know, we can imagine that family, in my case, that I wanted to have, or I can imagine doing the research that I wanted to do. And that can sometimes be enough to sort of keep fighting. What I learned from my mom's experience and also from mine is that really cannot be enough. We can't just hope and then wait. Most people look for silver linings during tough times because that's the right thing to do. Like, you know, even though I got Castleman disease, I got closer with my dad as a result of it. That's a great silver lining. It's like sort of finding that positive in the middle of a tough time. But what my mom would always say is, David, don't just look for them. Look to create them. Create something positive, a silver lining, out of something horribly negative. And forever, that horribly negative thing, you will remember the positives that came from it because you created something. So creating a silver lining is starting the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network to take on Castleman disease. Or it's starting every cure. Because I'm alive thanks to a repurposed drug, I sure as heck need to make sure I get this to more people. And so it's really about that hope. Action. It's about taking action. It's about not just reflecting and finding things that look positive, but it's actually making things that are positive.
Mm, I love that. When I was reading about your work, I was so excited. And also, I had a moment of puzzlement because in some ways, repurposing is what we do every day in medicine,
yep,
right?
Yep.
Off-label drug use is how drugs are prescribed. In fact, we're seeing that in spades with GLP-1. Now we're starting to get some GLP-1s that are more tailored to weight loss. When you use that term, how is that the same or different from what we've done forevermore in the U.S. around medical use?
It's a great question. So 20 to 30% of all prescriptions every day in the U.S. are off-label. As you mentioned, it happens so often. Unfortunately, it happens very randomly. So when drugs are used off-label, it's because a doctor has read a paper or guidelines, or they heard from a colleague that a drug might be useful in a new way. And it's truly random. And the reason that that drug was determined to be effective maybe in an off-label basis is because some researcher somewhere said, I'm going to try this thing for that thing in this lab at that time. Complete randomness. Up until now, we've sort of assumed that like the system's going to work itself out. You know, a great example of this is with Viagra that was repurposed from heart disease to erectile dysfunction, which most people are very aware of. What most people don't realize is that it was also repurposed for a rare pediatric lung disease called pulmonary arterial hypertension. Kids were not getting enough blood flow to their lungs. A doctor in Houston just thought to himself, I wonder if that drug that works for erectile dysfunction could get blood flow into these kids' lungs, and just decided to try it. And it worked. And the drug was on patent at the time, so the drug companies had an incentive to actually do this systematic work to prove that it actually works. What happens most of the time is that those ideas happen when drugs are already generic, because 80% of drugs are generic, so the majority of drugs are generic, and there is no path forward to prove these things actually work. There is no systematic way to say this thing might work for that thing. And so the world we're in is one of those worlds of sort of waiting and hoping. Let's hope that it happens. And so I love that you connected this to turning hope into action, because that's really what every cure is about. It's about getting away from a world where like, let's hope that this doctor tries this thing out at this time and I see that doctor at the right time and I get the right drug, to let's systematically look across every drug and every disease, all 4,000 drugs, all 18,000 diseases, let's systematically score how likely every drug is to treat every disease. And then let's look at the things at the very top of the list that are the quote unquote lowest hanging fruit. And let's go push those things forward so that it's not some random doctor making some random observation, or the flip side, no doctor making no observation and patients not getting the medicine.
Talk about sort of the production function that you have here. So first of all, I love that framework of systematically testing these kinds of connections, not doing it in the random bespoke cottagey way that we think about it happening otherwise. Talk us through the production function, including how you're using AI to do those matches.
Sure. So we start out with what's called a biomedical knowledge graph, which is really, and we use a handful of different ones, really mapping out what's known about human biology. So every drug, disease, gene, protein, all mapped out in really a two-dimensional space. And then edges, which is just lines connecting each of those biomedical concepts, describing the relationship. So GLP-1s treat diabetes. GLP-1s increase insulin receptor expression. Every single biological function of every single disease, gene, protein, all mapped out with edges explaining the relationship between every one of these functions, which is really our way of saying, like, what do we know about medicine? And then we start training machine learning algorithms on known treatment relationships. Like, we know siltuximab treats Castleman disease, and we know GLP-1s result in weight loss. So we train algorithms on known treatments, and we say, machine learning algorithms, these are good treatments. This drug works for this disease. Look at the pattern of connections. Look at the gene connections. Look at the expression connections. Look at the treatment connections. Like, this is a good treatment. Now look across the rest of this graph. All 4,000 drugs, all 18,000 diseases, and give me a score from 0 to 1 for how likely every drug is to treat every disease. And so I mentioned before, 4,000 drugs, 18,000 diseases, that's 75 million possibilities. If you tried every drug for every disease, you would have 75 million attempts. And so what artificial intelligence can do is it can look for these scores, it can quantify them, and then now we can rank order the list and say, well, what are all the 0.99s? I mean, what is AI saying looks really promising? Because us humans, we can't look at 75 million possibilities and sort of start to rank them. What we can do is we can look at the top 100 or the top 1,000, and then we can dig in further and say, wow, this drug looks really promising for this disease.
I've heard you talk about prioritization and prioritizing suffering. Mm. So I can imagine if you tried to do that ahead of time, you might not end up with the kinds of matches you needed.
Yeah.
So how do you prioritize after you have those scores?
Yeah, it's a great question. We do it sequentially. So the first score is the what we call biological rationale, basically the likelihood of success that that drug's going to treat that disease. You get a score from 0 to 1. So that's what our medical team that's based in Boston then starts to look at, the things at the top of the list. As they start going through things at the top of the list, they're asking the question, how likely is this? I mean, AI is predicting that it's going to work, but like, how likely is this? And a lot of times, to your point earlier, maybe someone's already been giving it off label. Like, there actually might be human data. So, you know, they're looking to see how likely is it, what data exists. And they're also asking, what's the unmet medical need score? How bad is this disease? What is the unmet medical need for this particular disease? And that factors in to whether it gets moved forward into what's called a med review, which is where now an MD, PhD or MD, PhD trained scientist will do about a 2-day long dive into the particular drug repurposing idea. What is the reason that DFMO might treat Bachman-Bupp syndrome, for example, which happens to be one of our programs? And then after those 2 days, it then gets re-presented to our medical team to say, based on what we've seen in these 2 days, is it worth spending the next 2 to 3 months really digging into this to really understand why would DFMO treat Bachman-Bupp syndrome? And if we say so, they get working for the next 2 to 3 months, and then it gets presented to our scientific advisory council that looks at anywhere between 2 to 5 repurposing ideas a quarter and then says, wow, this looks really promising. Let's move it forward. And we put together a proposal. Are we going to do lab work to really prove it works? Are we going to do clinical trials to demonstrate that it works in patients? Or in some cases, we actually come across cases where the trials and work have already been done. We just now need to get the word out about it. And so once it gets to our scientific advisory council, it's really the question of, is it going to get endorsed? And are we going to do the thing that we think needs to be done to fill the gap?
I was particularly interested in that last group because there's a famous stat, which I don't actually know if it's been validated, that it takes 17 years to get a known practice into use in the U.S.
Yeah.
It feels like actually longer than that when I look at some of the things people suffer from. So that last mile is not about a scientific discovery. It's about changing practice, right? I feel like if we can crack that, all of the other stuff is easier because we actually aren't stuck in this halfway there mode. What have you learned about that?
Yeah, it's a really good point. So I think that the 17 years for adoption, I think is really relevant when you consider all drugs for all diseases, which includes arthritis medications where there's 7 other arthritis medications that already exist, or it includes maybe a birth control pill where there's already 15 other options. It's just how do you get the 16th one into practice? That 17-year time frame doesn't hold up when there are no drugs approved for that disease. It doesn't hold up when it's a deadly condition. Fortunately, doctors are a little quicker to start using medicines when the patients are going to die from the disease, thankfully, and when there's nothing else. Yeah. So I think that that's where we like to go. We like to go where there are no other treatments. We like to go to the diseases that are left behind, where there aren't treatments and there's major unmet need, which makes it easier for adoption. Still doesn't mean it's easy, but it's a sure as heck a lot easier than, you know, trying to be the 17th blood pressure medicine than it is to be the first drug for a deadly disease.
So it works.
It does work. Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite examples is a disease called DATA2 syndrome. DATA2 is very rare, hundreds of kids diagnosed in the U.S. I don't even think it's in the thousands, maybe thousands worldwide, but very rare. DATA2 syndrome causes children to start having strokes at a very young age. It's horrible, and they have hundreds of strokes, and they often die in their teenage years because of the accumulated effects of having hundreds of strokes. It's horrible. About 20 years ago, almost 20 years ago, a doctor decided to try a TNF inhibitor that he had in his vial, because he was treating one patient with vasculitis and he had another patient with DATA2 syndrome. And he thought, you know, this patient with DATA2, they kind of look a little bit like my patient with vasculitis, and I've got some leftover TNF in my syringe, so I'm just going to try it in this patient with DATA2. And the patient stopped having strokes. This kid stopped having strokes. Didn't know why. It wasn't sort of like, I'm going to do this for any sort of good. Like, he didn't do proteomics. It was just, I'm going to try it out. It worked. Kid stopped having strokes. Started giving it to other kids that he had with DATA2. They stopped having strokes. It was about 10 years from this doctor doing this and helping kids in his clinic to an amazing doctor in Nashville, Tennessee named Chip Chambers, sadly having a couple kids that were born with DATA2 syndrome. And Chip heard about this TNF inhibitor that was helping and, you know, wanted to get his kids on it. And he started a movement. It's called the DATA2 Foundation, where basically he got physicians, researchers, patients, everyone working together. I was honored to be able to advise to come up with guidelines on how do you treat DATA2 syndrome. How do you get all the data together to prove that TNF inhibition works? He did that, got it together into guidelines, started getting the word out. Now every kid diagnosed with DATA2 syndrome gets a TNF inhibitor. And the reason this is important to point out is that when that doctor started using it almost 20 years ago, and then a couple doctors here and there started using it, that's the old way that information got disseminated, where it was just random chance. Oh, I met this doctor at this conference, and she tried it here, so I'm going to try it there. And in the meantime, hundreds of kids are dying from strokes that are totally preventable. Like hundreds, probably thousands over the course of those 10 years. Thousands of kids are dying from strokes while the world knows that a TNF inhibitor could be helpful, but the doctors who treat them don't know it. And so to your point, how do you bridge that gap? Well, you bridge that gap with someone like Chip Chambers, or in this case, you know, like Every Cure, where we actually do the proactive work to get the data together, to develop guidelines, to email and call and Facebook message and post as much as we can, so that way no kids don't get this medicine when there's something that can help them.
I think it's been 14 drugs so far.
That's right.
Is that correct?
That's right.
So for those 14 drugs that you've repurposed and you've identified a known treatment pathway, is it generally the clinicians that find out about it, or is it often the patients themselves?
It's both. It's both. You know, I think that at the end of the day, as you know, in our healthcare system, the clinician is the one who's going to write the script. And so the clinician has to believe in the data. They have to trust the pros, the cons. They have to really understand it. And so the real quote unquote gatekeeper is the physician. However, patients have some agency in our healthcare system too, and they get to decide and talk about, you know, whether they're going to take the medicine, or maybe they can advocate for themselves or their loved ones. And so in some of those conditions, I mean, DATA2 is a good example. You know, Chip didn't just reach out to doctors. He made sure that there were Facebook ads and social media posts that helped to find a lot of patients and their families, and their patients and those families went to their doctors and said, hey, take a look at this paper. When you've got a great article, and then you can also do sort of this guerrilla sort of marketing to patients, I think that's really what you need.
And those disease groups can be so powerful. So activated.
So powerful. I mean, these groups they're run by parents of kids with these horrible diseases.
So you've repurposed 14 drugs, and your goal is to repurpose 15 to 25 treatments by 2030. It's almost 2026. And so I'm just curious what your path is going to be to scale to that number.
Yeah.
And then eventually to the thousands of other ones that you want to do.
You know, the first 14 that we worked on that we advanced, only two of them did we utilize artificial intelligence to help us to get to answers. The other 12 were sort of the old-fashioned way, where we did proteomics and we did tissue staining and we did IHC and we did flow cytometry and all the stuff that we still do in my lab. I run a lab at Penn and we still do that work. We will always do that kind of work because it's so important to validate these findings and also to generate new findings. But artificial intelligence gives us the ability to scale that a lab like mine never could without it. So, you know, we can study a few diseases at a time. We can study a few drugs at a time. And that's, you know, requires literally like a few million dollars a year to do that sort of scale of work. What AI does is it lets us look across, you know, the 4,000 versus 18,000 possibilities, the 75 million every drug versus every disease. So you can hone in on what we consider the lowest hanging fruit across all drugs and all diseases. So like, you know, in my lab, we have particular rare inflammatory diseases, autoimmune diseases, and rare cancers that we focus on. There may or may not be a drug out there that could treat one of those diseases we're working on. It could have been that Castleman's, that there wasn't a sirolimus waiting for me. And I think that there are a lot of diseases that don't have a drug out there that's going to treat them. Like there's just, there are a lot of diseases where there's just not a repurposed drug to save those patients' lives. I strongly believe that that is the case. I also believe that for every disease where there is a drug that could help a patient, it's our responsibility to find it. So it's not going to treat every disease, but everyone who could be treated by it should be treated by a drug that we already have. So by using AI, that can help us to figure out what drug for what disease is the lowest hanging fruit across the whole forest. By finding low hanging fruit, we're going to be able to maximize impact in the shortest period of time.
It should probably be occurring to many of the listeners that the financial incentives are not well aligned for this work. That if you're a pharma company, you get a lot more by producing a new drug that will be under patent than you do by repurposing generic drugs that are off patent. I was interested in your conversation with Adam Grant. One of his pieces of advice to you was don't give up too soon on whether there could be a partnership, given the big quest within pharma right now to find new pathways forward. So I have two questions around incentives. One is, what could that look like? And the second is, if you discounted that, what would be other pathways to making the economics work?
Great, great question. So 80% of drugs, as I mentioned earlier, are generic. Once a drug is generic, or even when it's approaching becoming a generic drug, that means that there's going to be multiple manufacturers for the drug. The price is going to plummet. So for a given drug, there might be 10 generic manufacturers of the same drug. So now you've divided the market by 10. So each company is going to make 1/10 of what they used to, of what maybe the original innovator made. And the price is going to plummet maybe to 10% of the price before. So now if you were the original innovator, now you're making 1/10 of 1/10. So you're making 1% of what you were making when the drug's on patent. That is not profitable whatsoever. And so you're not bringing any dollars in. And even if you were to double the sales of your drug because you found a new disease area, now you've gone from 1% to 2% of what you got before. Okay. Right. So you've doubled sales because you found a new disease area and now you're making 2% of what you made the previous year. So there's no incentive whatsoever for our system at all to find a new use for a generic drug. Zero incentive. So, well, as a result of that, you can probably guess. There's never been a single example of a generic drug that's gone on to get a new disease added to its label. Isn't that incredible? I mean, there's not a single example.
I do have examples where it's gone off patent and then they try to get a new patent.
Yes, exactly.
For a new indication.
Of course.
We have that all the time.
Because that's what our system incentivizes. And so, yes, so a drug that's off patent, you can find a new dose, a new formula. You go through the 505B2 pathway. It makes sense. And it's not that anyone's evil or people are holding things back. That's just what our system incentivizes. So no one ever goes through the process to find a new use for an existing medicine that's generic. Instead, we find new doses and new formulas of old medicine. And then we make them new medicines. And the old medicines get sort of pushed aside. So when you have a system like that where 80% of your medicines, there's no incentive to find a new use, but the 20% that are on patent are big dollar amounts, and the, you know, whatever number it is that are in development have a potential to be big dollars, companies can't justify spending tens of millions of dollars or even single millions of dollars on an old generic drug. So they spent zero. So that's sort of the system that we're fighting against, which is a really tough market. But then to Adam's point and to your point, how can we work with pharmaceutical companies? I'm really, after my conversation with Adam, he always makes me feel optimistic. I am optimistic, maybe cautiously optimistic, that we will identify a few really cutting edge, patient-centric pharmaceutical companies that want to work with us, because I think that, as Adam was indicating, and I do agree, those companies where their drug is about to go off patent or it's recently gone off patent, they've spent billions of dollars, they've made billions of dollars, their company knows that drug, you know, backwards and forwards. If they just told us the names of the diseases that they consider but didn't pursue, because the average drug company will consider between 10 and 20 diseases for every drug that they get approved, they only pursue a couple of them. And so just sharing with us, what are the other, you know, 10 or 20 that you thought about but you didn't pursue? That alone, even with data, or with data be best, but even without data, that's still helpful for our team to then sort of dig and say, well, what's our AI platform predicting there? You know, is there something there that we're seeing and they were seeing? That's sort of a partnership where it's just information flow on things that are post-competitive. It's not like, I mean, this is like, you're done with it. Just tell us what you learned. We'll run with it. I think that there's a path for that. We just haven't, we haven't found the right partner yet, but I do believe there are a couple out there that we'll find that'll do this. And that I believe the rest of the system will join on.
On the other hand, for anyone looking to bring more health at a lower cost, this, whether that's a Kaiser or some health systems are motivated by that, not all of them. So I'm curious whether you've seen interest from some of those other large players that have better aligned incentives in this direction.
Yeah, we have seen interest from insurance companies. Because to your point, using an inexpensive old drug for a bad disease where they're going to be paying for hospital costs and all kinds of medications, that's really good for their finances. And so I think that we're really aligned from an incentive perspective with payers and with patients.
Yes.
You know, patients, yes. It's clear, right? Like patients, they want solutions. We want answers. Like patients, it's like so clear. Payers, I think it's also clear. And we just haven't figured exactly how to work with pharmaceutical companies, but I think we will. Mm.
Some of the stories you've talked about are truly poignant, so amazing, including a boy who told his dad he loved him for the first time. What is a story that just keeps you going? What is one of those stories that really you turn to when you need to keep going on a day when it's hard?
Yeah, and this is such an important question because there are a lot of hard days. You know, mixed in, there's a lot of these amazing days, but there's a lot of hard days where we're working hard. And yes, the positive stories motivate us. I will also say the stories of patients we weren't able to help motivate us as much as the people where we were. It's that combination of the people we can help. We love those. It's amazing. The people we can't help, it hurts so bad that it creates a bit of a circuit between the two. And then we help someone and that makes us feel better. And then it's sort of this challenge that we go through. But one that really stands out for me is a quite personal one in my family. And that's actually my uncle Michael was diagnosed with metastatic angiosarcoma in 2016. His doctors told him that there were two chemos to try, and when they didn't work, that he was out of option, that he was going to die in the next few months. Everyone at the time died within a year of diagnosis of metastatic angiosarcoma. And we did something really simple. I did a PubMed search to see if there were any data in PubMed on a treatment for angiosarcoma. I mean, it was as naive as you can get. But I found that there was a study published 3 years earlier in a journal that showed that there were 5 patients where their tumors from angiosarcoma patients were stained for PD-L1 expression. And 4 of those 5 had increased expression. And what we knew in 2016 was that if your cancer has PD-L1 expression, you're more likely than not to respond to a PD-1 inhibitor, or at least you're more likely than if you didn't have PD-1 expression to respond to a PD-L1 inhibitor. PD-L1 inhibitors at the time were approved for melanoma and for lung cancer. They'd never been used for angiosarcoma. But I talked to his doctor and said, you know, well, first off, we got the study done. And then I said, you know, would you prescribe this? He said, never been used before. I'm not going to prescribe it. So anyway, we got it. We got Michael on the medicine and he had the most amazing response to it. Literally within weeks, his tumors were gone. Basically his immune system destroyed them because that's how PD-L1s work. His immune system got them under control. A year ago, last September, it was 8 years from his diagnosis, and he walked his son down the aisle on his wedding day, my cousin, Philip. And then a week and a half ago in Nashville, he walked my other cousin, Kristen, down the aisle 9 years after he was supposed to die from this disease. And the reason this one touches me in my heart in so many ways is that I sat and I cried with my Uncle Michael and my cousin Philip and Kristen about all the things that he would never experience. I mean, we sat together, we bawled, like he wasn't going to see them graduate college. He wasn't going to see my cousin graduate medical school. He wasn't going to be there certainly on their wedding days. And so one is that I felt the pain of what they were going through because it was pain I was going through. Also, it's so motivating for me because this study had already been done. We didn't even have to do a study. The data was already there. The world, someone had generated that study in 2013. It was there. The breadcrumbs were there, but there was no one to look for breadcrumbs. And so I think about what we're doing at EveryCure is we're picking up these breadcrumbs. Oh, there's an insight that a PD-L1 drug might work for angiosarcoma. It was published 3 years earlier. That's an edge in our knowledge graph. In our knowledge graph, there's an edge between PD-L1 and angiosarcoma from that paper from 2013. Those breadcrumbs are in our knowledge graph. And so that makes me optimistic that we're going to find more of those. And I think the third reason why I love that example so much is that that drug, pembrolizumab for angiosarcoma, is now in treatment guidelines and patients are getting it all over the world. Unfortunately, it only works in 18% of patients with metastatic angiosarcoma. But 100% of patients were dying within a year before this, and now we got 18 and somewhere in the 20% when you add a couple other drugs in that are living, past a year. And in my uncle's case, 9 years. And so I think that I love it because it shows that one little breadcrumb can result in a life saved and now hundreds of lives saved all over the world. And it just gets to this whole idea of turning hope into action. It's like, we hoped for something for Michael, but we didn't know if there was a breadcrumb there. But then that little breadcrumb just grew into something so much bigger.
I just had an event at the School of Public Health this weekend around bold action in this time of uncertainty. Mm. And I think many people are sort of deer in the headlights right now because of cuts to programs yes. like Medicaid, public health. And at the same time, if we can't turn that concern into action, all of the hopes and dreams we have for the future will not come about. No one else is going to pursue them for us.
Yep.
I'm just interested, you've lived with a lot of uncertainty in your own life and a lot of change and a lot of hope. What advice would you give to my MPH students about living and thriving and creating bold futures in this time of uncertainty?
Sure, yeah, it's such an important question. I think my life really changed when I almost died for the first time when I was 25 mm-hmm. years old. And that experience created a sense within me that I sometimes describe as overtime, time that I didn't think that I would have, where in a sports game, overtime is the time where you didn't think you'd have the time, but where like every second counts. If you make a mistake in the first quarter of a game, you can make up for it. Make a mistake in overtime, game over. It creates what can be really scary, which is this, period we're in where it's like sort of uncertain and like, we don't know how long it's going to last. And there's just a lot of questions. But it can also be really clarifying because you can say to yourself, my clock is ticking. I don't know how much longer I'm going to have here. So I'm going to do everything in my power to do the things that are really important to me. I'm not going to waste any time doing the things that aren't important. I'm not going to waste any time, doing stuff that isn't something I'm deeply passionate about. So for your students, it's this realization I've had, which is that I felt like I'm in overtime since I was 25, but we're actually all in overtime. Every one of us, we don't know how much longer we've got. And we can choose to live like we're in the first quarter and like, oh, it's all, we got plenty of time. Overtime's a long way from now, but we're actually all in overtime. None of us know if we're in the first quarter or overtime. The reality is we're all in overtime. And that can be scary, but it can be clarifying. And so if you can live with a mindset that you're in overtime and you want to make the most of every second, at least for me, it's given me so much joy in life because I get to go after those things that are really important to me.
We're here in New York during,
UNGO Week.
UNGO Week. It's like on the edge. There are all these terms that are used. It's Climate Week. Yeah. It's CGI Week. If you could have the attention of everyone who's running around like crazy on the streets today for 30 seconds, what is one thing you would share with them?
I think I'd share with them, and you're not going to be surprised by my answer. I think I'd share with them that we should be really proud about the progress we've made in medicine, but there are a lot more people suffering right now. And amazingly, there are drugs that could help them, but our system just is not constructed to do that. And so also amazingly, there's now technologies utilizing artificial intelligence that allow us to untap and unlock the hidden potential of our medicines, but it's going to take all of us working together. And I'm so thankful for the partners that we have right now at EveryCure. We're making tremendous progress. We've got a 50-member team. We've got the best AI team in the world. We've got the best medical scientists. We're driving forward research. We're helping patients, but there's a long way to go. There are 4,000 drugs, 4,000 diseases that have approved drugs. There's another 14,000 diseases with no approved drugs. We got a long way to go, and it's going to really take an all hands on deck effort. And so I don't think there's a single person, whether you're in healthcare or you're out of healthcare, that couldn't be a part of this solution. Every one of us is, you know, going to face illness today or tomorrow or the next day. And it's got to be something we all take on together.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining in this beautiful space, which you'll be back to in a couple of days.
That's right.
And so appreciated in your story. It's the grit, resilience, and hope, but tempered with the joy is just beautiful to see. Thank you.
I've loved this so much. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for giving me the opportunity to share about the work we're doing.
David's story is incredibly inspiring and captivating, but also so frustrating. Drug companies invest big bucks in discovering new treatments, but once a drug becomes generic and the price plummets, that motivation and investment disappear. And that's why there's been no prior systematic effort to do what EveryCure is doing, finding new uses for existing drugs. While David has not given up on partnering with pharma, so far he hasn't seen any movement. But still, health plans and patients are highly motivated to find drugs for rare diseases and more affordable and effective options for every condition. So here's to seeing more investment in getting all the health we can from the drugs we already have. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on David Fagenbaum and his work at EveryCure. There's more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.